So welcome back to the Birdie Bug Pod, episode 35. We're back.
It's been a few weeks, but we are now back.
Yeah, I don't know whether people realise it's been a few weeks, but it has been a few weeks.
Everyone's been on the edge of their seat waiting.
We've been a little bit distracted. You've been poorly.
I lost my voice, which isn't great for podcasting.
Yeah, it's not a great thing, is it?
You helped my brother move house and needed a weekend rest.
Well, but two of my boys have moved house in about 2 weeks, and I've been scraping walls in one of them and moving boxes in for the other, so it's been a bit busy.
It's all been a bit hectic.
Yeah, but it's good to be back. It's a nice sunny day. We are sitting here in our little studio, and we're going to talk today all about fungi.
We are, but hang on. For the first time ever, I actually have catch-up.
Excuse me while I just fall off my chair.
I've actually got a ton.
Hang on a minute. Yeah, okay,
I've actually got a ton of catch-up, and I'll go through it very, very quickly. I've been back doing lots of photography, so when I always say I've not left the house, I've left the house a lot.
Sun's come out, that's why.
Yeah, morning walk before work with the camera, so I've been back doing lots of macro photography, which has been lovely.
Check it out on A Bug in the Lens Instagram page.
Actually back to posting on Instagram, so that's been really fun. And then the highlight really has been that I've got a new camera.
Always exciting.
It is very exciting. I've been like a little child.
Actually really exciting for you because it's a different system, isn't it? System that you've been sort of using over the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years. You now have a new system.
Yeah, so I've gone Micro Four Thirds. I've got an Olympus OM1. I've built a really cool macro setup with a diffuser on the way and everything.
There's a hell of a lot of gadget in it, and you've got to sort it all out.
Yeah, so it's been a lot of fun playing with that for the last 12 hours, but I've got a lot to learn. But it's just nice to be back behind a camera. So
yeah, always.
That's been lovely.
Brilliant.
Have you got any catch up?
I saw a cuckoo.
Oh, yeah, you got a cuckoo photo.
I don't need any more highlights than that.
They've been taunting me for all
the time I've been doing bird photography, which is probably about 3 years now.
Just hearing them going cuckoo.
Hearing cuckoos, seeing people posting lovely cuckoo pictures up on Instagram feeds. I've heard them everywhere. And then RSPB, Pulbara Brooks, early morning. I was very lucky, actually, where there was a couple of guys with field scopes. And one of them pointed out there was a cuckoo in the tree and he could see it. And then it just suddenly flew across my eye line. Sun was behind me.
Got a cracking photo.
Nikon Z9 did its thing. Locked on. Got a great photo, which you can see on A Bird in the Lens Instagram page.
Some shameless plugs. Go see our photography.
Shameless plugs. I'm sure we'll get the Rivers Trust in here somewhere. Even though we're talking about fungi, I'm sure that will arrive at some... You'll find a way.
Yeah.
So I don't need any more catch up than that. I saw a cuckoo, photographed a cuckoo. It's a cracking shot. Happy days.
Not bad at all.
Yeah, that's all.
Well, that's nice, short, sweet.
Yeah.
We've been out taking photos.
Yeah.
So
onward.
Onward and upwards, all about fungi. I wanted to do this episode mainly because I wanted to title the episode What the Fungi.
It was the only reason, really.
Yeah,
wasn't
pretty
it?
Much. I think we should.
It's a great title.
I think we should preface the episode.
Yeah, both of those.
By the fact that normally we pick a species, and this time we've picked an entire kingdom. So
honestly, I've got more notes about fungi than actually I can collate.
We could have an entire podcast just dedicated to fungi.
Absolutely fascinating what I've learned about fungi.
So, you know, it's the equivalent of saying we're going to do an episode about animals.
Yeah.
So we're going to try and keep it relatively, I don't know, not surface level, but not dive too deep into any one aspect, because otherwise we could be here for hours.
I think we're just going to try and highlight the importance of them
from a climate point of view.
The threats that they are under.
Yeah, our normal species episode type thing, but all about fungi.
All about fungi, or what the fungi.
What the fungi. What the fungi is going on.
So it's over to you to, I think, to do the intro. So Maff, what are fungi?
Right, so there are slightly different estimates for the number of completely described species, but it normally sits between 150 to 200,000 known species of fungi. Most people, I think, assume just mushrooms, but it's actually just one small part of the fungi kingdom.
Yeah.
Everything from yeasts, which you know we use in bread and beer and stuff like that, to mildews, molds, and then obviously mushrooms as well.
I got rusts and smuts. What's a smut?
I have no idea what a smut is, apart
includes the yeasts, rusts, smuts, mildews and molds.
I mean, it's a great word.
I don't know what a smut
hold
is.
On, look, hold please, considering we should have had this in our original research.
We should have been...
Okay, well, I Google what is a smut, and apparently it's sexual material.
Yeah, okay, so we just ignore smut, should we?
Magazines, books, pictures, films that may offend some people because they are sexual in nature.
Yeah, I think you've made a mistake of not putting smuts in rather than smut.
Fungi. The smuts are multicellular fungi characterised by their large numbers of teleospores. They get their name from a Germanic word for dirt because they're dark, thick, walled, like telespores.
I'm glad we cleared smuts up.
There we go. That's what a smut is. Anyway, we got ahead of ourselves. So fungi are eukaryotes and not prokaryotes. So eukaryotes are what we are, animals and plants. And essentially, to go a little bit sciencey, it means that their cells contain other membrane-bound organelles. So in us, you've got things like mitochondria, chloroplasts, and most importantly, the nucleus, which obviously has our DNA, is essentially a clearly defined cellular organelle called the nucleus.
And they're not actually categorised as a plant, are they?
No. I'll get on to that.
Oh, you get onto that. Sorry.
Whereas bacteria are prokaryotes, where the DNA actually is just loose inside the bacteria. It's not in a membrane bound. They can be single-celled or very complex. And like you said, for a long time, historically, they were thought to be part of the plant kingdom. I'm assuming, you know, they grow out of the ground, and so do plants. And so people are like, we got animals.
It's a logical conclusion.
And we've got plants, and they included fungi in that. However, they lack chlorophyll, so they don't photosynthesize. And they've also just got a whole bunch of quite unique structural and physiological features, which, again, could actually be an entire episode because there are so many different kinds of fungi. But they do have their own unique features that make them, you know, distinct from all of the other living organisms. But one of the things that I think characterise them as something separate is their different way of obtaining nutrients. And so they have like vegetative growth, and they essentially just decompose matter and absorb the nutrients.
So they get their energy from their growing medium, I suppose.
Yeah, so whereas plants are taking it from the sun, and obviously we are physically eating and digesting, they are decomposing stuff and absorbing the nutrients. Obviously, I say we can go into it. We could do a whole episode on their physiology, but the mushrooms that we see are essentially the like the fruiting bodies. It's their spores. So underneath the ground is where the majority of fungi are. When we're talking about ones that become mushrooms, and when they're ready to release spores and propagate more mushrooms or more fungi, that's what the above ground mushroom is. And there are some. I've actually got a nice picture on a different Instagram account. And when you poke them, you can see the spores being
released.
You've
got a really good picture of that, haven't
which
you?
Is a puffball mushroom, for example. But yeah, one of their main distinguishing features is the fact that they digest organic matter externally and then absorb it. So it's quite a different way of obtaining nutrients. And so they became their own kingdom. So the three eukaryotic kingdoms being plants, animals, and fungi. And interestingly, considering the fact that they were thought to be plants, humans and fungi are more closely related to each other than they are to plants.
Oh yeah, I read that. I read that they're more closely related to animals than plants.
So,
which I found fascinating.
We share a common ancestor with fungi about 1.5 billion years ago. What's interesting is it's estimated that they colonised land about 1.3 billion years ago, which that's based on genetic analysis. And that would, if it's accurate, put them on land 600 million years before plants.
Wow.
However, we don't have any fossils because obviously they're soft and break down in the soil. So it's really hard for something like that to fossilize. So it's all based on genetic analysis, but that estimate would put them on land way before plants, which is really interesting.
Yeah, that is really interesting, isn't it? Because you wouldn't have thought that.
No, I think you always assume, you know, you've got bacteria and plants probably coming in first.
But, and you'd also would have thought that fungi obviously feed on
decaying
matter. So what came first?
Yeah,
the chicken or the egg, you know?
Yeah. And you've got, I've brushed over it, you've got three main groups of fungi. You've got the multicellular filamentous molds, macroscopic filamentous fungi that form large fruiting bodies. That's the mushrooms. And then you've got single-celled microscopic yeast. So it's important to realise that actually they vary hugely in size and structure and life cycle and stuff like that. So mushrooms are the ones that we can easily see. We can obviously see mold as well. I mean, some of them even cause diseases. You've got things like athlete's foot and ringworm being fungal diseases of the skin. So they're not all good for us. And I think, especially with things like a ringworm, people think that's a worm, but it's actually just it's a fungal infection.
Yeah.
And then we've mentioned it very briefly. We've got things like yeasts that we obviously use in cooking and beer. Obviously, they're used in antibiotics as well.
Their very first one, wasn't it? Penicillin was a fungal.
So they vary.
Fungal, wasn't it?
They vary in their...
A fungal mould on a...
Abilities, massively. You've got some that will kill you if you eat certain death cap mushrooms, for example.
Well, I think there's only, it says in the UK, relatively few of our fungi are poisonous, although some would make you pretty unwell if you ate them, but two are particularly dangerous. And they've both got great names. One's the death cap and the other one's called the destroying angel.
Yeah, that is a good name.
And those two will do you some real damage.
I think the the joke, or like the question people always ask, is when you go back to, I don't know, say early man.
Yeah.
Is who's characterising these? Because you've got some like chicken of the wood that if you eat, and the beefcake mushroom, which if you eat, delicious, tastes quite meaty, full of good nutrients. You've got some like the death cap that will kill you, and you've got some that will let you see into the fourth dimension and send you on a proper trip.
Yeah, some are really hallucinogenic, aren't they?
How are people working out? It's like, well, Jeff ate that one, he's dead. Bob's eating that one, he's having a great time. It's just like someone that...
Actually, it's a fascinating fact. Do you want a fascinating...
I'd love a fascinating
bit,
fact.
Bit of fact is that they found a... he was called Otzi, the Iceman. They found a mummified man up in the Alps, actually, between the border between Austria and Italy. He's really famous...
Fossil,
encased in ice.
Not quite a fossil, but...
And his remains were, I think they were found in 1991, but he was discovered with two species of fungus in his pocket. And they, obviously there's been a lot of...
deliberation
as to what he... Why. But they think there are a number of... There are a number of theories. One was that one of the fungi, which was a birch polypore, a white bracket fungus, may have acted as a natural laxative or an antibiotic. Scientists think Otzi may have been self-medicating to treat gut parasites, which they found in his corpse. Or he was using the fungal skin as an antiseptic plaster to protect his wounds.
That's also really interesting.
I mean, they still obviously don't know for sure, but the fact that they found two little pouches of fungi in his... on his person was amazing. Really.
Yeah, well, I mean...
That was like 5,000 year old,
man,
I reckon.
Mankind and early man have been using fungi for all sorts of things for, well,
I found,
huge
I thought that was
time.
Amazing little bit of information. So,
I've got a few like funny little interesting facts before we delve into the meat of the episode. Obviously, and I know you've got this one too, the largest organism in the world by area is a fungus. Which is
absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah, it's a species of honey fungus discovered in 1988, estimated to cover roughly 2,384 acres of the Oregon forest. Yeah. And it's survived for over 2,400 years. And again, I think it's important to emphasise that, we see the little... mushrooms poking out the forest floor, but actually the huge majority of the organism is in the soil and creating all these networks, which I'll go into a little bit later. But the fact that it's covering over 2,000 acres
is insane,
is ridiculous. You got any cool little fungal facts?
Well, things that I just never would have thought of. Over 100 species of fungi have been found to degrade plastics.
Yeah, which is something else I'm going
to
talk about.
With two species
later.
Being able to break down samples of plastics within 140 days. And I just never would have thought that was possible. So I found some really interesting stuff like that. Fungi are all in our homes. So the enzymes produced by fungi are used to make household... items, for example. Stonewashed jeans require an enzyme produced by fungi which breaks down the cotton to make them feel softer. Plastic used for car parts and Lego are all made using a fungal enzyme, itaconsic acid. And these will, I mean, obviously when you think of fungi and mushrooms, you think of
food or
maybe drugs or penicillin or things like that, but actually breaking down plastic now, obviously we'll go on to the fact that that's being researched heavily for obvious reasons.
Yeah, it's one of those where I remember if I go back in time to my biotechnology masters, we had a whole thing about these, the way it's either bacteria or fungi typically are producing a whole host of really clever enzymes and chemicals for breaking stuff down, yeah. or causing different chemical reactions. And so sometimes you're not even using the whole fungi, you're just trying to hijack the mechanisms by which they can produce these enzymes and then use that enzyme as a starting point to create something else. So in the world of biotechnology, fungi are insane because they're like little chemical powerhouses.
They're absolutely incredible. Found out so many facts about, because one of the reasons where we didn't know so much about fungi for many, many years is it's like an underground world, yeah. that we hadn't got any idea about, but we obviously it's being researched really heavily now. They are absolutely,
I mean, the one that obviously probably people think of, The Last of Us being the video game and now TV show of fungi taking over the planet, is the ones that create zombie animals. And so you have these fungi infections that take over the brains of carpenter ants, and the fungus likes a very specific habitat, and essentially it infects the brain and causes the ant to take it to the habitat that it wants, and then basically hijacking the nervous system of another animal and creating a its own little transport system. I've seen it in, I think they do it to worms as well, these weird, or it might be in snails actually, that these odd like growths coming out of their head as the fungi causes them to transport it to where it wants to be, which is quite freaky.
Yeah, they are absolutely amazing. And you're talking about ants and their relationship with things like ants. There's a brilliant little section here. Some fungi have a more benign relationship with ants, and leaf cutting ants is a typical example. And so it's a fungus called
So hard to pronounce, yeah, aren't they?
I actually cannot pronounce it. It's a fungus that lives 5 meters underground, and it enlists an army of ants to collect freshly cut leaves for it to eat. And it even tells the ants what type of leaf it wants, communicating with them via chemical signals. So it's absolutely incredible. And the scouts work like little waiters in a restaurant, carrying the food to order to the workers above the ground. And they're literally just carrying up to 50,000 leaves a day to feed the fungi.
Incredible.
And in return, they also just supply the ants with a regular food of mini mushrooms all the time.
So great little relationship.
This lovely little symbiotic relationship. So these worker ants are just working non-stop, and in return they get food.
That is very cool. It's one of those weird things where you know that so many of the ant behaviors are controlled by pheromones and chemicals, and so it makes sense that a mushroom could hijack that system, but how that actually evolved is just mind-boggling.
Yeah, and again, the more you read into it, the more you realize that they also, they through these chemical signals, they can alert the plants that they're got a relationship with that may be under threats from insects and herbivores. They send chemical signals to those plants to alert them of any threat of predation. It's absolutely a fascinating world that we could talk about non-stop for about a month, but we have to be careful that we don't just keep talking about how amazing,
especially as you've mentioned, as a symbiotic relationship with plants. Should we delve into the climate world?
I think that's one of the key points we want to sort of emphasize today, isn't it?
So obviously, this podcast in general, we normally talk about things relating to the changing climate and environmental issues, whether from a conservation point of view or something similar. And so I think it's often overlooked and easily so. Like you said, it's a big underground network. We're not always, what we can't see it. It's very easy to overlook the importance of fungi when it comes to climate change and the role that it can have in hopefully helping us mitigate some of the impacts of climate change. So the main way they do that is through this symbiotic relationship that you've mentioned between plants and trees. And so, like we said, most of the fungi is underground, and they actually interact with the plant or tree roots. And it creates this thing that has been dubbed the Wood Wide Web, which is really cool. And actually, the most recent David Attenborough documentary, the one that was all focused on the UK, had a fantastic like simulation or animation of what the
It was a really good sort of graphic interpretation of it, wasn't it?
Reminded me of when you see like the animations of what brain neuron sort of transmitters are doing with all those electrical impulses, but underground between fungi and trees. And so it's incredibly together with working in this symbiotic relationship, they help to store more than a third of the world's annual fossil fuel emissions, or essentially remove the third of the world's annual carbon emissions. And so it's these mycorrhizal How did you say it?
Mycorrhizal.
Mycorrhizal. Yeah. Let's go for that. Mycorrhizal fungi. And so in these big networks in the soils, whilst they're both alive and after they die, they essentially form a really crucial part of the organic matter within soil. And obviously soil itself, when it's healthy and functioning properly, is a massive carbon sink. And so it's actually estimated that about 75% of Earth's terrestrial carbon is stored within soil.
I've got 13 gigatons of carbon around the world is stored beneath our feet.
Yeah, which is...
by a vast underground network of fungi.
It's insane.
Which is equivalent to 36% of the yearly global fossil fuel emissions.
Yeah. So it is
insane.
It's massive. Yeah. We always think, you know, carbon sink-wise, you've got the oceans with their sort of algae and the sea floor, and then you've got the forests, as well as like wetlands, yeah, etc. But actually... terrestrial carbon, 75% of it is within our soil. Although, to be fair, some of that isn't wetlands because peat is essentially, yeah, a bit like soil, or it's decaying matter. So this relationship between the fungi, plants and trees, which they have dated to have been sort of evolved around 400 million years ago, they literally colonize the roots and then they supply really crucial nutrients to the plant or the tree. Whereas the plant provides them with sugar.
Yeah.
So during photosynthesis, you take carbon dioxide, and one of the resulting chemicals are sugars, essentially, or resulting compounds. And so that's fantastic. The fungi really want the nice sugars, and then they produce the plant with all sorts of like nitrates and other little nutrients that the plant needs to thrive.
And alert them of danger.
And alert them of danger. Yeah. And the difference in productivity of forests and plants that have this relationship with fungi compared to the ones that are lacking the fungal network is massive. And so when we talk about wanting to keep our forests, you know, healthy and natural and absorbing carbon and storing carbon for mitigating climate change, what we need is nice healthy forests with a really good solid underground fungal system to boost,
yeah, actually,
that
there's been an awful lot of scientific research that has shown that that there's certain root fungi that help trees absorb CO2, yeah, much quicker than
makes
others.
Them more efficient.
Yeah, so which is a fascinating thing, isn't it?
Yeah, and again, we could easily spend an hour just, yeah, delving into how that had the science behind some of,
yeah,
that, but it would end up becoming quite a heavy episode. But I guess it makes sense. If they're supplying nutrients that allow them to grow,
yeah,
it's going to increase their, yeah, demand for carbon. So they're going to want to be able to absorb even more. You've given a number already, but the amount of carbon that they're absorbing each year, I think they to put it into easier to understand terms,
I'm not sure what a gigaton is.
No, but they absorb all pretty much the equivalent to the annual emissions of the US and China combined.
Wow. Yeah, that
puts it into,
puts
sort
it
of
into perspective.
Perspective.
Yeah,
one
definitely.
Of the things that's not known quite so much is actually what happens to the carbon within the fungal structures after they die. Or once they've taken it in, some of it will inevitably be released back into the atmosphere when the fungi respire, a bit like us. But even when they are being, well, after they've died and they start to decompose, there are carbon molecules combined into the soil and actually even be reused by plants.
Yeah.
So it creates just a nice storage, healthy system of carbon underneath our feet. I've got so many notes, but I think we're at risk of diving into this relationship too much. So
yeah, I think emphasising the importance of carbon sequestration.
Yeah, so sequestration.
That's the one. Sequestration.
So the TLDR, or too long didn't read, is that, which is very typical on things like Reddit, huge fungal underground network binds to plant and tree roots, increases their ability to absorb carbon dioxide, supplies them with valuable nutrients, and the plant provides them with sugars. And it's really crucial for storing a ridiculous 75% of the land's carbon in our soils. So healthy soils, healthy mushrooms or fungi, healthy plants.
Yeah, and I think, again, the research by a lot of the scientists have come out and sort of said that mycorrhizal fungi represent a blind spot in carbon modelling. It's something that hasn't been considered
about, yeah,
on a big enough scale. And actually, the numbers that they've uncovered are absolutely jaw-dropping in the effect of fungi and carbon.
Yeah,
and
you mentioned that the relationship, they can help the plants be alerted of potential,
yeah,
dangers. That's also thought, and the research on this is actually quite thin and a little bit new. But it's thought that the fungal relationship with plants will help them actually tolerate climate change as well, which again makes sense. If you've got an underground system providing you with nutrients and the above ground environment starts to deteriorate and struggle, you've still got a source of nutrients and stuff being given to you. So it makes sense, but the actual research into that is a little bit, it's just new. However, as always, our fungi are in a bit of trouble.
Yeah, as always.
It's always the case, isn't it? So,
and I hesitate to say it again, but it is pretty much the same offenders.
Culprits, yeah. So, I mean, for example, the UN has warned that 90% of Earth's topsoil, and that's obviously where a lot of the, that's where we grow our crops and all sorts of like that, could be degraded by 2050, which is quite alarming. In part, this is due to, I say, normal culprit of intensive farming practices.
Yeah, it's intensive agriculture and our use of fungicides.
So obviously fungicides are a very obvious, it's very clear what happens. It kills fungi, which is not good, because whilst we have the very beneficial fungi underground, which can actually boost crop production and be really important for increasing yield and even protecting the crops from attacks from things that might eat it, or maybe even climate change. The flip side is, a bit like the fact there are fungi that infect humans, there are lots of fungi that will kill plants.
Yeah.
So there's all sorts of problems as far as fungi actually being parasitic on plants. And so you spray it with fungicide, but that seeps into the soil and kills all the good fungi at the bottom. It's exactly the same problem we have with insecticides. Farmers want to kill the aphids and the insects that are eating their plants, but the byproduct is the insecticide is not specific and it will also kill all the bees.
Yeah.
So the problem is, if they're spraying the crops, is you're disrupting that network in the soil. And so obviously losing this fungi and losing the healthy soil is catastrophic for climate change. As I mentioned, it could also be catastrophic for our ability to even grow food, because we need the fungi in the soil. But as you said, they're a bit of a blind spot. And so a lot of our conservation and our restoration efforts don't focus on this, which is, I'll go on to people who are trying to change that. Beyond the fungicides, say obvious, does what it says on the tin, kills fungi, pollution is a problem. Specifically,
it's nitrogen pollution.
And nitrogen pollution comes from two main sources, burning of fossil fuels into the air, and then that will then eventually rain, and you get sort of nitrogen-rich rain, which obviously then gets into the soil. And also agricultural runoff, because fertilizers. Because nitrogen's really important for plants. However,
And the trees that are partnered with this mycorrhizal fungi, they're extremely sensitive to nitrogen pollution.
Yeah, and so essentially, research in the US, for example, has found that forests exposed to high level of nitrogen pollution contain far fewer mycorrhizal fungi. So it's quite a clear impact. But it's also very prevalent. Let's say agricultural pollution is, we don't normally think of that as algal blooms, the fertilizers wash into rivers and then cause a big algal growth. But also in the process of being washed into rivers, it's going to be absorbed by all the soil as well. So nitrogen's bad. Did you have any other fungal issues you want to touch on before I go on to some of the slightly more
positive
things?
I did have a little fact that I wished I'd put in my facts earlier on, because I think this gives you an idea of just how important and how widespread fungi are. 90 to 95% of terrestrial plants in all ecosystems on every continent have a mycorrhizal relationship with fungi.
Which is incredible.
Isn't that amazing?
It's so widespread.
90 to 95% of all plants. So if we kill off the fungi, we won't have plants.
Yeah.
It's as simple as that.
And
if we don't have plants,
we don't have anything.
We'll die out. We're gone.
Yeah, in the same sort of line of thinking of it as a blind spot, we always talk about saving the forests.
Yeah.
And a big part of that, apart from obviously not chopping them down, is making sure they've got healthy soils to grow in and the fungi in there.
One of the big things, obviously, is ploughing and tilling soils is a really bad thing. And I've got a little example of that. We talked about, which I found quite fascinating, is the rewilding project of the Knepp Estate. I'll try and keep this really brief, but I think I mentioned in the episode that they brought in an arboreal expert on, particularly on oak trees, to try and save a 500-year-old tree that had been on this estate and was starting to really look, maybe come to the end of life, and they wanted to know if they could save it. This guy came in and said, that's fine. And that wasn't anywhere near any of their fields that they were ploughing or fertilising or whatever. And he said, now that just needs topping and crowning and it'll be absolutely fine. We'll look after that. He said, the biggest problem is that line of oak trees over there that's really close to your fields that you're ploughing, because they're the ones that are really struggling, and they're struggling because you are, the soil condition is affecting the micro rhizal community and relationship that the fungi are having with those trees. So you stop ploughing, stop tilling, improve the soil around those trees and they will recover. They will thrive. And that proved to be true. And the owners of the Nep estate had no idea about this underground relationship with fungi and the trees and the plants. And I thought that was a fascinating thing. The younger trees were the ones that were struggling because they were near the agricultural
areas,
of the agriculture on the soil. And yet the 500-year-old tree that was away from that, was, he said, you get another 4 centuries out of that if you just crown it and top it and we look after it.
Yeah, because, I mean, there are like strategies where farmers should rotate what they're doing with fields, which ones are in use and which ones aren't, because the constant ploughing and destroy it just disrupts the whole thing. We could honestly, even fungi aside, even though they are a massive part of it, we could do an entire episode just on soil and how important healthy soil bacteria are, for example. So looking after the soil is obviously crucial for then providing the habitat for
fungi. And actually, it's not also just about trees and woodland. It's also about grasslands and the way that the grassland's been... I mean, lowland grassland areas are really good for fungal, thriving fungal as well. And, of course, we've been clearing those for grazing land and what have you. So
building on them, stuff.
And that's having an effect too. So obviously the habitat loss is a massive thing.
Yeah, as it is.
As well as the soil condition, it's habitat loss mainly. But
sadly, the fungi are in trouble because, like we said, we're destroying the habitat, degrading our soils.
Yeah.
I've got a cool foundation who are working hard to try and help fungi.
Yeah.
There are a few, but the one that really stuck out, they're just called the Fungi Foundation. They have a cracking website. Essentially, their mission is to try and they envision a healthy planet in which fungi are recognized as the interconnectors of nature. What connects all of the other nature is our underground fungi. And so that's what they want it to be recognized of that importance.
Which sort of relates to what I was saying about 90 to 95% of our terrestrial plants are all linked with fungi.
And I'm not saying they shouldn't, but obviously plants, you know, get so much attention as far as... conservation efforts go and what we need to restore and planting native and all that sort of stuff, but we need to make sure that we're looking after our fungi as well. And so they essentially work to increase knowledge around fungi. They promote solutions to some of the conservation issues. They do a lot of education and awareness around the importance, as well as some of the sort of novel applications of fungi. And then they advocate for their, this is the big one, I think, they advocate for their consideration in conservation policies. And so again, we're so many environmental organizations are campaigning for the recognition of trees and rivers and stuff like that to be, or not, they almost have some sort of rights as far as their conservation goes. And the Fungi Foundation want fungi to be included in that. They need to be recognized as an important part of restoration. We have things like if a building site goes up, you have to plant X number of trees. If you're building near a river, you need to have all these systems in place, but we need those systems in place for our fungi as well. So they just want them to actually be part of the conversation.
It should be part of the conversation, because I did that thing about, for the RSPB, I did an article about biodiversity net gain in development, which they talk about, you know, you have to build a pond or, as you say, plant trees.
There's something in there.
Or leave a little bit of green space, you know, for wildflowers on the edge of the development and what have you, but no mention whatsoever of obviously fungi.
Yeah,
so that's actually really a good... I might actually have to think about that and think about doing an article about that.
Yeah, even when you're factoring in the environmental impact of a project, is the impact it will have on the... subterranean fungal community, is that also considered? What's going into the soil and what will that do to the fungal community? So one of their big missions is trying to make sure they are part of this conversation and they are recognized as being so important that they need to be a part of the solution as well. We can't overlook fungi. They even have really cool citizen science initiatives, and obviously we love a bit of citizen science, so you can actually even get involved in fungal recording, for example, through the Fungi Foundation. So if you want another citizen science activity, because we always give you VTO and Rivers Trust and all sorts. There we go, got a mention.
you managed it.
Got it in there.
Actually, that's a good thing about the citizen science, because I was going to mention about, there was one called the Lost and Found Fungi Project, which was an initiative by Kew Gardens.
Yeah.
And in fact, you can go on the Kew Gardens website, and I will put this link in the show notes, because it's a nice little video, 6-minute video that they did about protecting, how we can protect fungi. And that was a volunteer citizen science. It was a 5-year project. It did start in 2014. I think it's finished now, but I think they're going to try and roll it out again, which was just about recording fungi.
Yeah.
It started up in Scotland, actually, and it was all of these volunteers and fungi enthusiasts, and they started a Facebook page, and then finally it became sort of a recognised published project.
Yeah.
And so, yes, we talk about citizen science, and it's absolutely vital.
Yeah,
and the Lost and Found Fungi Project, you can find out lots about.
I mean, we banged on about those, but it is that thing. It's very hard for an organisation to get people across. We stick to UK because it's obviously where we're based, across the entire UK monitoring. So you need people monitoring the birds everywhere. You need people monitoring the rivers everywhere.
Oh, there's some real fungi enthusiasts as well, because there's some very, very rare fungi. And in fact, again, if you ever read Wilding about the Nep Estate, this guy who came in to look at the oak trees and was sort of yomping around the estate, which is a vast estate, looking at the trees, got really, really excited because he found a very rare fungi where you can probably only find, that you could only find in maybe 2 or 3 places in the whole of the country.
Yeah, well,
and they found a fungi on this Nep Estate, and he got more excited about that than anything else.
Well, for example, every autumn, obviously Josh had been on the podcast.
Yeah.
I'm fortunate, but we're both fortunate enough to live quite close to the New Forest.
Yeah.
And in the autumn, we go out doing fungi photography.
Hence your little puff.
Yeah, so we've got
puffballs,
and we sit there with flash guns, and we find puffballs, amethyst deceivers, I can't remember the name, these beautiful orange ones. Josh has found dead man fingers. It's the devil's fingers, and there's a fingernail looking one as well. So we go out hunting for, not to do anything other than to take photos, but just to see these bright orange and dark purple and ones that smell like death and all these really cool
fungi. Like, you know, you get
twitches,
bird enthusiasts, you get people that are really enthusiastic about finding fungi and rare fungi. But now what they're doing is they're getting those enthusiasts to actually record it. Then they're building up some really, really serious data about the effect of fungi, whether it's, you know,
they're
what
doing
can be
well
found.
And,
exactly,
yeah.
Ones that are doing well, ones that aren't. Then they're able to look into why, and they're able to look over a period of time as to the effect of whether the amount of fungi is reducing in areas and why. So that data is.
Citizen science is brilliant.
Data is so important. There's no other way of determining the effect on the ecosystem without this data, you know. So,
we've probably been talking for quite a while now, haven't we? So essentially, we need them to be part of the conversation, crucial to climate change, and there are organisations and things out there trying to get that going.
Chile. Did you know about Chile? The Chilean
government.
The country
or the food?
No, I just got to throw this in because there's a mycologist called Juliana Fursey, founder of the Fundación Fungi Foundation, first NGO in the world dedicated to the protection of fungi. And she took her knowledge to the Chilean government and was successful in bringing fungi into environmental legislation. Fungi are now written in the Chilean law, leading to extensive protection in the country.
Oh, that's exactly what we want.
Campaign success. She's one of the most enthusiastic people in the world and the true ambassador of the kingdom of fungi.
That's incredible.
Fungi, but
what a legend.
Chilean law.
Yeah.
That
that's exactly
fungi
what
has
Fungi
to be
Foundation are trying to do here.
Exactly that. So it is possible.
Yeah.
And if you have a proactive government that actually will listen to the facts and the science, and that's the important bit, if you can go with actual fact and actual scientific evidence and data, then they can't refute it, can they?
So
anyway, the Chilean government, fair play, respect to you.
It must be hard rocking up to like a council meeting and being like, I want fungi in law, please.
Particularly our government. Sorry, I shouldn't get political, but particularly our government.
Yeah, but that's one of the main things, because the research into exactly how we can conserve them beyond keeping soil health and stuff is relatively new. The big thing is just trying to make sure they are recognised before they're lost. But beyond the carbon sequestration and their relationship with trees and plants, there are actually some unusual ways that fungi can help us with environmental issues. They can help us with all sorts. I mean, medicines.
Well, medicines, yeah.
So there's loads of stuff we can do, but I've obviously focused on the environmental technologies. I'll kick it off with, because you've mentioned it already, breaking down plastic.
Yeah.
So obviously they are natural decomposers. That's literally how they survive. They decompose matter. They've had millennia to perfect that system. But could they decompose other things? Essentially was the idea behind this this research. And in 2017, scientists in China and Pakistan identified a strain of Aspergillus turbinogensis, is what I'm going to say it. Turbigensis, actually, breaking down plastic in a landfill site. Essentially, it's a fungus that you find in tropical soil, and it can actually cause crop spoilage, so it's not necessarily what you want to find in your soil. But they discovered the samples could break down a certain type of plastic in just a matter of weeks, but it's not a very hard plastic. I decided I didn't want to try and pronounce it. And so now
there's a lot of unpronounceable words in this episode.
Now you've got scientists, a collaboration between scientists at Kew Gardens, Portsmouth University, China, and I think it was University in California in America, who are working with fungi from the genus Trichoderma, which includes the one I just mentioned, and to see if they can essentially efficiently degrade harder plastics like PET, which we get in obviously plastic bottles and food packaging and stuff like that. And basically what they're trying to do is engineer the enzymes. They're using the enzymes produced by the fungi as a starting point to then create more effective compounds that could break down harder plastics. And a separate research project over in Sydney actually got a strain of Aspergillus teres to degrade polypropene after it being pre-treated with heat and UV light quite quickly. So it would be a way of just trying to speed up that decomposition. When you think that most, I think it's like every bit of plastic we've ever produced still exists today, because it takes thousands and thousands of years to degrade, and we haven't been producing it for that long. If you could speed that up to a matter of weeks or even months, that's a huge difference between 10,000 years or whatever it would normally be. So could they degrade plastic? Probably. It's just a bit of biotechnology.
Also been found to help degrade various pollutants from the environment. We've talked about plastics, but petroleum-based products as well, pharmaceuticals and personal care products, and oil. And as they say, some of these substances are persistent toxins, which means they take a long time to break down, and fungi break them down relatively quickly. So
obviously you've mentioned their oil and chemical spills, but even nuclear waste.
So I didn't
apparently
know that.
They were used, and I probably should delve into it, but there's too many rabbit holes that I almost fell down. They were actually used after the nuclear disaster at Fukushima.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so they can be used to help reduce nuclear waste, which again is
that's amazing.
Mental. As long as you don't start producing radioactive fungi that can cause zombies.
Yeah, that wouldn't be good, would it?
on the pollution side of things, also, just as a random fact, they're commonly used in wastewater treatment because they can break down pollutants in effluent, which is quite interesting.
Can I just throw in another couple of unrelated but
hit
little
me with fungi
facts? Fungi have given us statins to keep dangerous levels of cholesterol at bay.
So you say that sounds like the thing you do with heart pressure,
as well as
pressure,
new
it?
Drugs for use in chemotherapy as we fight off cancer. Immunosuppressants sourced from a variety of fungus species have made possible every single organ transplant that's taken place since the first kidney donations decades
ago. Makes
sense,
because the problem is you do a transplant and your body rejects it and the immune system attacks it, and so you need the immunosuppressant.
Isn't
that really
amazing?
Cool.
So, and then, of course, we could go on to the fact that they're being used for sustainable materials.
Yeah, well, I'm going to go on to that
right
now.
You're going to go on to that bit?
Fungi foam, mate. Yeah. Fungi foam. So,
clothes, apparently.
Yeah. Fungal growth, actually, it basically just creates a cheap, simple, eco-friendly way to bind agricultural byproducts together. So they take things like rice hulls or wheat straw and bind it together into a biodegradable, carbon-neutral foam. And it's actually becoming quite a popular packaging material as opposed to things like plastic peanuts, for example.
Yeah.
And I couldn't find a timeline on this, but apparently IKEA have indicated a commitment to using fungal foam packaging.
Really?
Which, if you think of the amount of packaging you get in those flat packs, they can, unbelievably, these fungal foams can also be used in construction for insulation, flooring, and panelling. So, you know, instead of, again, having these weird, very non-biodegradable insulation, I don't even know what it is. It looks like cotton, but it's not cotton.
Yeah.
Fungi foam is an alternative. And if you isolate just the mycelium, which is your underground network, not the big mushroom bodies, you can actually produce much more flexible and spongy foam that people have used in facial sponges, ink and dye carriers, shoe insoles, and even cushioning. So we could have a whole world built on fungal products. And obviously it degrades very nicely because it comes from the soil.
And I could talk about the fact that the humble mushroom is a superfood in its own right.
Well, I've got stuff on that as well.
I'm giving you little prompts.
It's great segues. Right.
Yeah. Carry on. Let's right. talk about the fact it's low calorie and high in fibre and packed with vitamins and minerals.
Corn. Probably the most famous and widely known like meat substitute. Yeah. I'd say before, you know, we talk between the two of us nowadays how easy it is for us to find, you know, vegan chicken alternatives and yeah. vegan bacon. But historically, I think, like growing up, vegetarians, you always think they eat corn, which is spelled with a Q. I'm not just saying corn weirdly,
yeah.
corn, which is a, it's another fungi I can't pronounce. Fusarium venatum. Sounds like a Harry Potter spell, that does. Fusarium venatum. Essentially, it produces a digestible protein with a really good coverage of essential amino acids, as well as, like you say, all sorts of important nutrients.
Low in calories, rich in proteins, yeah. vitamins, and antioxidants.
And so we've spoken about the impact of agriculture, especially animal agriculture, yeah. on the land and on land use and water and carbon production and things like that. So corn mince has a land footprint that is 8 times smaller than beef mince, and a water footprint 10 times smaller than beef mince. Yeah. And the greenhouse gas emission is 13 times lower than beef and fourfold lower than chicken, because people always think of chicken as yeah. being the, and it is more, it is, you know, it's less demanding on the land than beef, but corn is still 4 times lower in emissions than chicken production. Just to put that into context for the sort of more recent developments, the Beyond Beef burger is about 10 times lower in carbon emissions, whereas corn is 13 times lower. So it's actually incredibly eco-friendly. The only caveat for us is that a lot, not all, but a lot of corn products have egg in them, obviously.
Yeah.
So not all of them are vegan friendly. They're typically vegetarian friendly, but healthy, low in calorie, high in good nutrients.
Shiitake mushrooms are known for their high content of vitamin B5, essential for the health of the nervous system.
That's pretty damn good.
There you go.
To be fair, I mean, I love mushrooms.
I love mushrooms too. I mean, the
big oyster mushrooms are just yeah. are just banging, is the technical term yeah. for that. So essentially, yeah, I won't go into too many others, but the recognition that they're important for climate change is one thing, but just on a weird tangent is that all the other ways that they can help produce sustainable materials, feed the planet in a more eco-friendly way, help us remove pollutants from wastewater, clean up nuclear spills.
Absolutely,
it is absolutely
amazing,
insane.
Amazing.
What they
thing.
Can be applied to.
Yeah.
And I guess it makes sense. You know, you've got 200,000 described species of natural decomposers producing all sorts of enzymes.
Yeah.
I mean, medicines. The only, not sad, but the negative thing is as climate change progresses and the temperature warms up, is we are actually seeing potentially an increase in frequency of fungal diseases in humans. So that's another bad thing about climate change, is actually the disease rate could go up
yeah.
as far as fungal infections. Yeah. But let's face it, if that's going to happen, where we find the antifungal properties is probably going to be from the fungi
yeah.
system.
Yeah.
So they might even be able to solve the problems that they're causing. But yeah.
Fascinating, fungi. Fascinating subject. Honestly, I learned things that
you should see how many notes he's got. We barely scratched the surface.
And we were meant to be, we were determined to try and make this a relatively short episode, and we're now on 51 minutes pre-edit.
So
we could, honestly, we could talk for ages about it, as we mentioned. But what we wanted to do today was just try and bring some awareness on what amazing things fungi are.
Yeah, it was.
It's not just, you know, from even just from their relationship with plants. It's just how important they are to the health of the planet.
Yeah.
I mean, they are. I can't overemphasize that. The things I've read, I just cannot overemphasize how important they are.
It's very much been a whistle-stop tour
yeah.
because each of these sections, you know, the relationship with the plants, the different technologies,
yeah.
the medical side of it.
Oh, they could I didn't even touch on any cultural stuff.
They could have all
Damn.
Been individual episodes. We could have done a whole episode just on the fungi carbon sequestration, a whole episode on different technologies based on fungi. But we wanted to just do a, like you say, an awareness raising thing of just like, if you didn't realise, look how cool fungi are.
Oh, I wanted to mention about the
the
magic mushrooms from that were maybe referenced in Alice in Wonderland.
Oh, okay.
Because obviously magic mushrooms have got this sort of hallucinogenic sort of... They reckon they've got a very similar effect to LSD, actually, in the way that they...
Work
on your on your psyche, I suppose. And there was a little reference. They think the first reference to magic mushrooms was in Alice in Wonderland, and it takes place amidst if she comes upon a large mushroom upon which is sitting an equally large caterpillar. If you've watched Alice in Wonderland...
I actually haven't.
I'm sure you'll remember this bit. The caterpillar tells Alice that one side of the mushroom will make her taller and the other side will make her shorter. And she's trying to find her way through this surreal land and she doesn't know how she's going to do it.
She's actually just on mushrooms.
And so she breaks off two pieces from the mushroom and one side makes her shrink smaller than ever and the other causes her neck to grow high into the trees. They think this was a reference by Lewis Carroll to the fact that the effect of the mushroom was making her feel like one minute she was tall and one minute she was short. And so there was a real thing about that. But
I always picture it as the magic mushroom episode of Family Guy where Brian cuts his ear off to stop World War II.
But yeah, there's quite a lot of literary references to mushrooms, mostly used in sacred rituals and but had an aura of mystery around them. Mushrooms were fairy food, used by witches as well.
Well, I mean, the rings in woodlands are called fairy rings, aren't they?
Yeah, they're also referencing Harry Potter, apparently. Fungi having sprouted regularly through literary history, including Harry Potter. I don't remember that. But anyway, so I'll stop there because I'm waffling away about cultural stuff now. So
hopefully you've got a new appreciation for fungi. I have.
I certainly have. Yeah, absolutely amazing. And again, you can help fungi in your garden by not tilling your land so much.
Yeah,
not digging too deep. And
fungicides.
Not using fungicides and pesticides and whatever.
Yeah, so, and stuff. And just looking after your soil.
Yeah.
We'll leave links to more
information. But be careful about which ones you eat.
Yeah. Don't eat the death cap.
Don't eat the death cap.
I mean, it's in the name. The...
Yeah, that is a bit of a giveaway.
Yeah, we'll leave links to a bunch of stuff in the show notes in case people want to go and delve more into, I don't know, the biotechnology or the climate stuff. Or
yeah, I do recommend also watching this little video that was put up on the Kew Gardens website. It's only about 6 minutes. A little presentation done by a guy, obviously an expert professor, and it really does emphasise why fungi are so important and what we should be doing about it. It's a really good little video. It's only 6 minutes. We'll put a link up in our show notes for that. So,
well, there we go. Fantastic fungi.
Yeah, thanks very much for listening to What the Fungi.
Yeah, What the Fungi's going on. I want that on a t-shirt. we'll catch you next time.
We'll catch you next time. Thanks very much. Bye-bye. Bye.